There's a story about a preacher who he was preaching and he was really going at it, but Brother Smith in one of the back rows was sound asleep, and he decided he was going to take care of Brother Smith. So he just calmly asked, "Everybody who wants to go to heaven, stand up now, please." And everybody stood up except sleeping Brother Smith. And so the preacher called out, "Brother Smith, I was asking if everybody wanted to go to heaven and you're to stand up, and you're not standing up. Why is that?" And he said, and he woke up and he said, "Well, I thought you were trying to get up a load to go now." We're on Mark 9, and like a lot of other chapters in Mark, it covers several topics, but the main one was transfiguration, so I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the transfiguration. And if you remember, Jesus, I had the Sea of Galilee drawn up here. Jesus fed the 5,000 up on the north side of the lake. And when he did, when he told his disciples, "We need to feed these folks," they were asking, why are we doing that? We don't have the money to do that. The question was why. Later, he fed 4,000 at the south side. And the question the disciples asked then was how. Showing some maturity in their faith. It was no longer why, but how. So there's some learning going on as he was doing this, but they're not done. All right, the transfiguration, we think, took place on Mount Hermon. Not sure, because it's not really described in that. And each of the three Gospels, well, first of all, Mark was the oldest. Remember, Mark was written first, and it was based on Peter's descriptions of things. So he was writing from Peter's dictation, almost. But we're going to look at the three different versions of it. So the first is Mark. This was the earliest. Somebody's got Mark 9, 2 through 8.
"After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared with them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, 'Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' And he did, in parentheses, he did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a second cloud appeared and covered them with a voice, and a voice came from the cloud, 'This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him.' Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus."
A couple of things in here. One is Peter is so taken with what's going on, he's at a loss, and he's just babbling. Can I do something? What can I do about this, Jesus? This really looks special. How about if I build some tents for everybody? One of the commentators said this was a real mistake on Peter's part, because building a similar tent for all three put them on the same level. And they obviously weren't on the same level. So that was one thing. In some versions, they use the term launderer when they're talking about the white of his garments being whiter than any launderer could make. Some say fuller. And a fuller is a broader term used to describe somebody who prepares cloth, cleanses it, but also fluffs it up, gets it ready for use, probably in the manufacture of cloth. So it's getting it ready to become a garment or to clean one. So they're talking about that. It was interesting that they that he mentioned about being so dazzlingly white, and it was unreal. Another commentator mentioned that this might have been an overlap of the spiritual and physical worlds. That Jesus, who was here as a man, transfigured into the sinless version of himself. And you saw the spiritual, eternal, sinless version of Jesus. That's what he looked like when they saw him. That was an interesting thing. All right, who went? Who was there and witnessed this?
Peter, James, and John.
Peter, James, and John, the three musketeers, whatever, on the front end of this thing. And who appeared with Jesus?
Elijah
and Moses. Now, why do you think they were there? Why wasn't King David there? Why wasn't Solomon there?
Because he died. He died.
He who died?
Solomon.
So did Elijah.
Peter and James.
Moses was dead.
Well, I thought Elijah didn't die. I thought he...
Well, you're right. When his life ended, he was carried up.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's an interesting perspective on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they certainly knew who they thought Elijah would be.
Well...
I don't know about Moses, but...
They represented the law and the prophets.
Bingo.
Okay. What did she say?
Moses represented the law, and Elijah represented the prophets.
There you go.
So it was the culmination of everything that's gone before. These represented the transition to Christ. Commentator said, passing the baton. That everything that's gone before is now in the hands of Jesus. That was great. So that was Peter's version, and he was an eyewitness, and Mark wrote this down. So then Luke used some of Mark's writings as a guide to his own writing, and he was really known as a historian, and he did interview people who had seen things. So what he wrote was documenting eyewitness accounts. So he probably talked to Peter at some point. Somebody's got his version, Luke 9, 28 to 36.
About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving, Jesus Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and enveloped him, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and told no one at that time what they had seen.
It's interesting in a couple of places. One is that Luke adds the word chosen, that God said that. Peter, in his babbling about building the booth, is off track. And God stopped him. He said, "Wait a minute. This is my son. Listen to him. Listen to what he has to say." So he stopped Peter in the midst of his carrying on. Anyway, Luke adds the word my chosen to what God said, and also that Luke focused on the look of his face more than the garment, which is what Mark had talked about, was the full glow of whiteness and brightness about him. Luke talks about the face. Actually, so does Matthew. Somebody has Matthew's 17:1-8.
I do. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up on a high mountaintop by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah, talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus.
Matthew, remember, he wrote for the Jewish audience. He added a reassurance from Jesus that Jesus touched them and said, don't be afraid. This is not something to worry about. In all three accounts, they talk about the cloud that came and God talking about his son, listen to him. Do you remember where God spoke, where people heard that he, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased?
It's when John was baptizing.
Correct. When John was baptizing, the Spirit of God descended like a dove and rested on him and said, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased.
Isn't a description of in Matthew of Jesus, his face shining like the sun, the garments like white as light? It's very reflective of Revelation.
Yes, very much so. You're right. It's a great tie. And again, Matthew and Luke both focused on the face. Mark was pragmatic, talking about the robe and the whole appearance. But these other two were talking about the face that was there. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man should have be risen from the dead. So they did keep that promise. They kept the matter to themselves, but questioning what the rising from the dead meant. All right, so we talked about the activity, the transfiguration event itself. Let's talk about the witnesses. First of all, Jesus told them, don't tell anybody about this until after I have been raised from the dead. They didn't understand about raised from the dead, but they did understand the part about don't tell anybody. Okay, so they kept that promise. But after he was raised from the dead, they then boasted, advertised, proclaimed it. Somebody's got 2 Peter, first chapter.
We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory, saying, This is my Son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain.
John also talked about it in the first chapter, 14.
The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. excuse me. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth.
So they did tell other people in their letters later on exactly that they were part of this and full witnesses. The next piece of it is the significance. So these three disciples saw this glory. And after this thing, after Moses, well, let me back up too, because one of the things they mentioned was that Mark mentioned Elijah first, the others mentioned Moses first. But one of the questions that comes up later is about Elijah coming before Christ comes the second time. So keep that in mind. Anyway, so after this is over, the other two disappeared and they see Jesus there by himself after all this glory. But now he, Jesus, knows he has to proceed to his death solo. The baton has been passed. He's now got his duty and he goes forward alone. The disciples are debating, which is amazing.
Right.
These guys, but you got to relate to them, because you think about what would you do if you're in the same case? How much of it would you have understood? And what would you have done with it? So I have to cut them some slack every once in a while. But here we go, from Mark 9. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one that they'd seen what they had seen until the Son of Man should have risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, "Elijah does come first to restore all things," basically before Christ comes. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. So Elijah came first and was mistreated as Jesus is being mistreated. It was interesting that they were discussing this at this level about Elijah and his prophecies and whether or not he was coming. One of the things that occurred to me was great minds discuss events. Average minds discuss things, and simple minds discuss people.
Is that... Talking about Elijah coming, is that the prophecy in Malachi 4?
Yes, it is. Thank you. But it was commented one that this was probably one of the better teaching moments Jesus had with his disciples, that they were starting to put stuff together about the Son of Man and the sequence that Elijah's supposed to be coming first, as in Micah had foretold that. And Jesus is confirming, yes, indeed, that's exactly correct. And in fact, it is proceeding like it was forecast. All right, so that was about the transfiguration. It was a most significant event that Christ, while he was on the real physical world, met with members of the spiritual world to discuss the future and what his duties were going to be. That's where they went. All right, the rest of the chapter has a couple other things in it. One is about the disciples trying out their skills and capabilities. So, but the first thing, and this is one of the first things that happens after this great transfiguration had just happened. He's had this great encounter, And he comes down off the mountain with his three disciples, and the other nine are down there arguing with the scribes. Scribes, always the scribes. All right, from Mark 9. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who's possessed by a spirit that was robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him on the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid." That might have described an epileptic seizure. "I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they couldn't do it." "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I have to stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." And I really relate to that comment, that I have the faith, but at times it's weak, and I need help strengthening it. So that's what the father's saying. And when Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And the spirit shrieked, and that may have been Satan screaming in defeat at this moment. He convulsed him violently and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, "Why couldn't we drive him out?" He replied, "This kind can come out only by prayer and fasting." Now, a lot of scholars agree that the term "and fasting" was added later. That really what he said was, it comes out through prayer. In the process, did Jesus criticize his disciples for not being able to do it? No, you're correct, he did not. Why do you think he said it only works with prayer? What was he telling the disciples? That they need to stay in constant touch with the source of the power they've been given, which is God. And the communication we have with God is through prayer. And that's one of the things Paul said later on. He said, in all circumstances, pray. Good, bad, indifferent, pray. Be in constant contact with God. And that's exactly what Jesus was telling them. You just need to be in better contact with God. You'll be able to do these things. Okay. Next topic was fear. And fear sometimes comes in times of semi-understanding, is what I would say. How many times have you been in some kind of a discussion and you think you know what they're saying, but you're afraid to ask because you don't really want to hear the answer? It might be embarrassing, or it might be something that causes you to be uncomfortable, that you need to change, you need to do something different. And that's one of the things that's going on here. The disciples, They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching the disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. They were concerned that they might actually know what he was talking about, and they really didn't want to hear him say it. They just did not want that. Jesus was telling them about his coming death. You remember Peter said the same thing when Jesus had told him earlier, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered and killed." And Peter said, "No, it won't happen. I'll be there and I'll protect you." And Jesus rebuked him at the time because he said, "That's Satan talking through you." Right after he had made his great confession, and then he made that statement, that was Satan jumping in. They think they know the answers, and they're just afraid about it. And I saw the parallel myself to some of the investigations that are going on right now in Washington. I said, you know, it's about what did you know and when did you know it? And if you knew it, why didn't you do something about it? And that covers a whole lot of situations. So that's where the disciples are. Another problem they had was pride. And Mark covers two of these things. And the first is when they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What are you arguing about on the road?" And they kept quiet because they had argued about who was the greatest. "Jesus likes me best. I'm going to be the one at right hand." All right. The silence, they didn't respond to him because they were embarrassed about it. After witnessing this transfiguration and the miraculous healing of the boys, these guys are down to talking about themselves and who's going to be the biggest and best. And Jesus turns this around in another teaching moment. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." And it was interesting that Jesus used a kind of a play on words. He used the Aramaic word talia, which meant child and servant. And what he was proposing here is that your life should be about service, not about adulation, not being first. As a matter of fact, you should be committed to serving people who can't repay you. Like a child, you do good things for a child, and the child couldn't do anything for you. So treat your fellow humans the same way. Don't worry about getting paid back. Do the things that are helpful. That's one of our commitments. And then prejudice. The disciples were just getting the hang of curing people and casting out demons. And now they're asking, what are they supposed to do? And "Teacher," said John, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name. And we told him to stop because he's not one of us." How come he's got the power? You know, he's not part of our inner circle. He's not part of our club. So he shouldn't be doing that. And Jesus turns around to tell them that they're going to need help to spread the word. This can't be done just by you 12. "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us He is for us. Truly I tell you, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. And as a matter of fact, that's why we're here as disciples. We're not members of that original 12, but we are part of the expanding circle to help carry on the things. We are learning the lessons that Jesus gave those disciples and using them, applying them ourselves. That's the point of all of this. My summary from this, first of all, don't agonize over your faults and shortcomings. Even Jesus' closest associates were subject to the same human vulnerabilities as the rest of the world. That's why I associate with these guys. They had pride, they had prejudices, they had fear, and they didn't pray enough. And I can relate to all of those myself. The other is to serve others who can't do anything for you in return. Seek service, not honor. Honor will come to the people who serve. That's what he said. So be the servant of all, and you'll be the first. If you try to be the first, you're going to be at the bottom of the list. That's what he said. Questions or comments? I like working with a group of good disciples. You guys are great. All right, well, we'll circle up then. Heavenly Father, thank you for the models of discipleship that you have provided, ones that we can relate to because we feel the same shortcomings that those men had back then, but we want to be good servants of yours. We want to overcome our own pride and desire for honor. Help us to be good servants and pray more often. Watch over us until we gather again in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.